From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll meet a German historian who was imprisoned by the East German secret police in 1981 for trying to escape to the West. Later, a naturopathic doctor was having difficulty treating some of her patients until there was a breakthrough.
We would try something different or we would augment a little bit. They'd do it 110% and they just weren't getting better. And then one of those patients in his home, they found black mold. And that was the boom. That was the moment that it was like, okay.
And the joys of writing noir fiction using Milwaukee as the city that never sleeps.
They're not bad people, but they make bad choices or they have bad habits. And noir is great for that. So that's what I was looking for, is how do I show a protagonist who's a good person, who means to do right, but just messes everything up.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. I interviewed our first guest today a little over 4,300 miles east of Milwaukee. I was in Germany as part of a journalist exchange program that was sponsored by the RIAS Berlin Commission. And I met Peter Koipp. Peter is a historian, but in 1981, he was a prisoner in a Stasi prison in Dresden. He had tried to escape to the West, and he was caught in the attempt. Today, Koipp lives in Berlin. He's finishing his dissertation, and he gives tours of the former Stasi prison, Berlin Hohenschönhausen. He agreed to share his experiences with me on tape, and we met at the former Checkpoint Charlie, the infamous Cold War boundary between East and West, to talk.
I grew up in East Germany in the communist dictatorship. And I remember when I was 16, my parents applied for an exit visa. They wanted to leave the country because my parents actually came from West Germany. And my mother more or less felt imprisoned in East Germany, and she always, you know, considered finding a way to leave the country legally and you know, at least safely. And when I was 16, they applied for this visa, and afterwards I had to leave the school. I, you know, was restricted in opportunities. I couldn't take the job I wanted to do. I couldn't even do the sport I wanted to do any longer. So I was like, they treated me like an outcast. And after 6 years waiting for the permission to leave, 6 years, you know, I spent a life between hope, because I always hoped that one day it will work, and disappointment because it never worked. After 6 years, I tried to escape. And my plan was to escape from Hungary to Austria. There was the border between these two countries was the Iron Curtain, and a remarkable feature or a remarkable thing at this border was the river Danube, and I wanted to swim through the river from Hungary to Austria, and I hoped myself to succeed that way, so that I can get to Austria, and from Austria it would have been easy to move further on to West Germany, but. I failed, so the Stasi, I was in the focus of the Stasi already when my parents applied for this exit visa, and they just waited that I leave my parents' house alone, and then they planned to find a reason to, you know, to put me in prison. So they did in July 1981, when I was on my way to Czechoslovakia. From there I wanted to go to Hungary. And when I came into Czechoslovakia, they controlled everything. They found the little binocula, and they found the compass, and you know, no reasons enough to send me to prison. And they brought me to Dresden, to the Stasi remand prison, and I spent almost 3 months in solitary confinement.
It is almost hard for us in the United States to understand that. A country would want to keep its people in so badly that they would take a teenager and put him in solitary confinement because he wanted to go somewhere.
Yeah.
How do you explain that to Westerners that come and take your tours? I mean, are they just shocked?
Yeah. First of all, I was a teenager when my parents applied for the exit visa. 6 years later, I was 22. It is difficult to explain. I mean, first of all, you have to You have to know that it was a dictatorship, and in a dictatorship you have to accept restricted, you know, opportunities to make a living. I mean, it was illegal to leave the country. According to the propaganda, the wall in Berlin and the border between the two German states was a, you know, a protection measurement to protect us from the class enemy and so on. Of course, the border and the wall was there to, you know, that we can't escape from the country. You know, many East German wanted to escape from the dictatorship, from the, you know, from the fact that you couldn't talk freely, you couldn't criticize the government, you couldn't travel, you couldn't get information from first hand. You just had propaganda newspapers, nothing else. And everybody who was fed up with the situation tried to move to West Germany, because it was the thing that West Germany accepted you as a West German citizen. As soon as you arrived West Germany, you were not a refugee, or you were not, no need to apply for asyl status or something. You were West German citizen, and it was that easy. You just had to make your way across the border. And many people tried this, but again, it was illegal. And the law was that people who mislead the law, that they have to go to prison.
There's a lot of change going on in the reunified Germany, about to celebrate 30 years of reunification.
Yeah.
And there are people in the south who want to, I hear noise about building a new wall, of walling off again. And what does that make you think? You tried so hard to escape. You went to prison to get out.
That's right. Are you talking about America or Germany to build up a new wall?
Germany first and then America.
Yes. Well, it is absolutely not understandable that people, you know, want to build up any sort of wall. It doesn't matter if it's in Europe or in the US, because from my perspective and from my experiences, people will try to cross any kind of border, however it is, you know, built, even if it's built like a fortress. And especially in Germany, with our past, with our history, to suggest, you know, seriously this kind of measurements, this is stupid. And I ask myself, for what? I mean, the world at the moment is a very crazy place, and we in the Western world, we are also responsible for the situation how it is at the moment. We can't say that something happens, you know, far away, and we are completely, you know, we have nothing to do with this. This is a lie, and so we have to accept that people, you know, try to find a place where they can make a better living, and so better we open up our mind and we give our hands to help. And of course it has to be done in order, in law order and everything else, of course. But first of all, we have to help, and we have responsibility. And for that reason, you know, what does it help? I mean, a wall just is not a solution for a problem. It's just an architectural, you know, thing of problem. It shows the problem, but it's not a solution. And for that reason, we need to find another way.
Does it scare you that so many people want to do that kind of wall building again?
I can't think that it scares me. It's more, I ask myself, haven't they learned from history? That's my question. And obviously not. So I just ask myself if it's possible to educate people. And again, obviously not. And, you know, the protectionism, which is quite common at the moment, it's not helpful. We have to face up the problems in the world, and we have to deal with them, to build a wall and to make us living on an island or on a tower or whatever. Is this the world we want to live in? That's my question.
You give the tours at the former Stasi prison here in Berlin, and is teaching people why you do that? I can't imagine that's easy for you to go in, even though that wasn't your prison. It was one very like the one you were in.
Yes. Well, actually to make these tours, to talk with people, to inform them about my experiences, to inform them about the, you know, the dictatorship in East Germany and what communism was able to create with people, and still creating if you look to North Korea. So it actually sort of helps me. I mean, there are some days, you know, I have my problems, and it's not that easy to get through this. But mainly it helps, especially if the visitors are interested in, and if I think they get what it's all about, and they get why we have to care about the democracy in our world. And actually, I appreciate that I have the opportunity to inform people that way. And also, it's sometimes not that easy.
I know when I went through it with you, I felt bad energy in that space. It was very hard to describe, but it just felt wrong.
Yes, I share this experience. So yeah, bad energy. The smell, for instance, the smell reminds me pretty much on former East Germany. So you had the smell in every official building, like a civic center or a hospital or school or something like this. So this is pretty much the smell of East Germany. And anything else, the tristness, the you know, the colorless environment, and that's what East Germany looked like. And you know that. The fact that it has been just 28 years or 29 years ago that all was still available and working. So yeah, that's right, bad energy, but we can leave this building. We can leave this building and we can leave it behind us. And on the other hand, it's good that it still exists as a memorial, because that let, you know, people feel many things about the dictatorship. And you know, actually communism wanted to be the most social and the most fair society in the world, and then it created something like this just against people who criticized the condition. And many of them, you know, didn't tend to completely roll back the thing. They just wanted to impulse little improvements, and even them disappeared. So everybody who was sort of critical or had other ideas or wanted to apply for changes ended up in such a prison. And that shows, you know, so much about how strange they misleaded the idea of communism.
What do your children think? Do you take them?
I guess so. I mean, it is difficult. I mean, in the memorial, mainly teenagers come, and you know, the teenage age is a bit problematic, and not everybody is able to get, you know, what's. But you know, I sometimes have groups with teenagers, and when they arrive, they are quite outrageous and quite. You know, they're making fun and thing. But then they get calm, they calm down, they get more quiet, they start thinking. And sometimes, even if the group is completely outrageous, but then sometimes I really wonder that they, you know, change during the tour. And actually, I never experienced a group which didn't show respect, or which you know, we're completely uninterested in everything. So the change, you know, of them is quite remarkable.
And like you said, it's important to tell the younger people what happened.
Yeah, sure. Especially younger people, especially people who, you know, were born in the democracy, and they could have the imagination, the idea that democracy is just always available and it's always there. But we, as adults and, you know, educated and informed people, we know that it can change if you look around in the world. So there are many countries. Maybe the most remarkable example is Turkey. I mean, it was a quite liberal democracy, and also the religion was not was nothing, you know, you saw or realized in first place. So Turkey always showed, I had always the impression that's an open country. And what did change? What did change for the free speech, for the free press and for the people there? And, you know, even young people has to know this kind of changes are possible. Even in more solid democracies like Italy or in northern countries, there are changes. And if people don't want to risk that the democracy is you know, just leaves or disappears, they have to do something. And this is my appeal to them.
We're sitting here right near Checkpoint Charlie, which was probably the most visible,
the most spot of the division.
Spot of the division, yeah. And you and I both first saw this in 1982 on opposite sides of the wall.
Yes.
What do you think of when you see it now?
Well, it is like on every spot, you know, not just Checkpoint Charlie, also the Brandenburg Gate or the Bahnhof Friedrichstraße or what else, the Bernau Street. And so, you know, to walk from east to west and from west to east that easy, that it's like a miracle for me still, even after 28 years. And when I get melancholic or emotional in this moment, then I look around and people are literally celebrating things. They make fun and they are in a good mood. I mean, it's their right, and it's actually very good. But I ask myself if they realize, you know, what 28 or 29 years ago at this place has happened. You know, being at this place meant 29 years ago, they would have shot to death if they would have, you know, made their way to this place. And I look around sometimes, appreciate that young people walking around with their parents or with maybe teachers or groups, obviously they are on the, you know, they research about the past and they are talking about this issue. But on the other hand, many other people, I guess, don't even realize, you know, what happened there. And that sometimes makes me not sad, but I think it was our status quo when we were a teenager. And now, actually, if you look back 29 years ago when the wall came down in Berlin, it all changed from one day to the other. Yesterday, you risked to be shot to death, and the next day, you can walk through. And this is history, and this is, you know, we all, sometimes I feel like a puppy in a play, in a theater play, or in a playground, or whatever. So, but it is how it is. I mean, to be sad, what does, doesn't it up? You have to accept.
Well, I am glad that you and I were able to sit on this side of the wall, and or what was the wall, and have this conversation. Peter Koipp, it has been such an honor to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a huge pleasure for me. Thanks.
Peter Koipp is a German historian and a former prisoner of the East German state. He spoke with us at the former Checkpoint Charlie in Berlin. You can find all of my RIAS Commission interviews from Brussels and Berlin at WUWM.com. Coming up next, a look at how household molds can impact your health and the steps you can take to mitigate it. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Mold is all around us, from those wet towels stuffed into an old gym bag to the forgotten carton of tomatoes sitting in the back of the fridge. Molds have found a comfortable home in just about every human domain. And depending on who you are, they could be impacting your health. Jill Krista is a naturopathic doctor based in Janesville, Wisconsin, and she's the author of a book that deals with the issue of mold-related illnesses. Titled Break the Mold, the book offers tips on how to deal with mold and how it can impact your health. Dr. Krista spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and began by explaining her approach to healthcare.
So as a naturopathic doctor, I'm trained to find and treat the cause. And most of the time when we can find the cause, whether it's food sensitivities or a lifestyle thing, something maybe genetic you were born with, and we can alter or assist that cause, get rid of the cause, and then alter the body's ability to deal with it, people get better. It's very elegant, and it's participative. And I had this small set of patients where they were doing everything right. I mean, 110% right. Not just, you know, most of my patients, they do 80% of it that they were supposed to do and still get better. And these are patients that would just keep coming back, and I can't believe they trusted me to keep coming back. We would try something different, or we would augment a little bit. They'd do it 110%, and they just weren't getting better. And then one of those patients in his home, they found black mold. And that was the boom. That was the moment that it was like, okay, I think this might be what's behind your barriers to getting better. And the more that I dug into mold, the more I found that was true. And then wondered if it also applied to those other, you know, quote unquote, stuck patients that were trying so hard and doing everything right but not getting better. And sure enough, there were evidences of water damage building and mold exposure in their history.
So when you say you dug into mold,
yeah,
what do you mean by that?
Mold is it's very well known in the research world. We understand this in animal husbandry. People who take care of animals and feed animals, they had to figure out mold because they were losing entire livestock because of mold infecting their food. So we started to understand it not only from an environmental perspective, but also from a feed standpoint. But research on humans is really lacking. So we don't really have good research on what kind of things will make a person better if they have mold exposure. Of course, the number one thing if you have mold exposure is avoidance. In my book, I talk about that. The first three things to do, avoidance, avoidance, avoidance. So you kind of get the picture of how important that is. If you don't get out of the moldy environment, there's no amount of band-aiding and chasing we can do to get somebody better. So that's the first thing. And in some cases, that works. People get out of the environment and they get better. But in some cases, they don't get better. And it's because the mold has now altered their immune system and has kind of moved into their body. And that's where we come in as doctors to help out.
When people think of mold, everybody has a specific idea of what that is, you know, spores that can kind of get into your body. But what are the different types of mold that people encounter on a daily basis?
That's a really good point to bring up because people associate mold illness with an old building where it smells musty. You can tell that there's visual mold. But in many of the cases that I worked with, there was no evidence of the mold. The most toxic part of mold has no scent. And that is the part that can move through building materials. Those are called mycotoxins, mold toxins. You can be breathing that air and having the exposure and getting ill from things that have nothing to do with the spores. So I think of mold illness as a math equation. It's both spore illness plus mycotoxin illness and chemical illness. So mold also spits out chemicals like VOCs and things that you would have in new materials. Some people really are intolerant to those, so now that's another piece of their toxicity that's piled on top of their problem.
Is there a specific place in a home or in a building more generally that you're going to find mold?
Any water intrusion. Okay. I would say in our area where it's so humid and then we have these uber-tight homes, we have a real recipe for disaster. All of the building materials we're using are lined in paper, which is mold's favorite food. It's an easy to digest carbohydrate. So we line our house with paper. We don't manage humidity. Mold can grow at over 50% humidity. Think about that. Like in our area, in the summertime, we can be at 80 to 90% humidity day after day after day. So if you're not doing something to actively reduce your humidity, mold can grow because you have a tight home made of paper on the inside, and all that humidity. But I would say most commonly, the building biologist that I work with who does the mold inspection, she has yet to see a finished basement that doesn't have some degree of mold growth.
Hmm.
Whoa. Now, is that enough mold growth to be affecting the people inside or the animals inside? Maybe not, but she's finding it in every building she looks.
So if you're someone who is having an issue with mold, how do you know? What are the kinds of symptoms that you're going to have?
That's the really tricky thing about mold. It doesn't have a diagnostic symptom. And that's why I think it has gone unrecognized for so long and why I wrote the book, because I wanted to create an awareness about all the various ways that mold can show up. It can affect every system in the body, and it can create almost any symptom because it depends on your genetic weaknesses. So you might come from a family that has a lot of irritable bowel disease, and then if you move into a water-damaged office and you start getting worse irritable bowel symptoms, you can say, well, this is my family dynamics and it's stress. But that's why I created the questionnaire in the book, because I wanted to give people an idea of a risk factor, you know, taking all of the things that mold could be creating and comparing it to all of the things you might be noticing in your body and give you a risk of, yeah, it's probably not mold. It's probably something else. Maybe it's diet, lifestyle, things that we can address. And then there's high-risk people and then somewhere in between. So it gives you a way to know. I would say the number one thing that we see is fatigue. That can be masked with our hypercaffeine use in our culture. And also some level of anxiousness, some level of inner unsettled feeling. I would say that of all of the people I've worked with that had mold, those were two factors. And it doesn't have to be crippling fatigue, although it could be, depending on your genetics, how long you've been exposed and how much you've been exposed to. But it's a marked change in your normal way of being.
A lot of the symptoms on the questionnaire also correlate with various autoimmune disorders, autoimmune problems. How do you dissect mold from those kinds of issues, and should you?
That's a really astute observation that you made. The reason why a lot of the things on the questionnaire address autoimmune is that mold will create an immune deficiency in the body. And if you look at other congenital types of immune deficiencies, the number one thing that they get is more infections, which you can see with mold. The number two thing they get is more autoimmune disease. So the autoimmune disease, I see it as immune confusion and exhaustion. So it's just firing off at anything because it doesn't have the distinction and the energy anymore to figure out what to freak out about, basically. So yeah, you'll see immune deficiency symptoms, and then you can have an increased incidence of autoimmune conditions.
So your book is, of course, called Break the Mold, 5 Tools to Conquer Mold. What are some of those tools? If you're someone who believes that you are having these kinds of issues, or someone who already has autoimmune problems that aren't going away, what can you do to combat mold, at least?
Mm-hmm. Well, the 5 tools in general are avoidance, which we talked about. Get out of the mold and get away from it in your food, get away from it in your environment, your hobbies. You would not believe how many people I worked with that have mold toxicity that were attracted to things as their hobby that just made their mold symptoms worse. So we have historic building people that love to go stay in historic buildings and tour historic buildings. Brewmaster, I had librarian. I mean, and that's just a bunch of paper. It's amazing to me, the hobbies. So avoidance, number one. Number two, fundamentals. Getting all of the fundamental things that you would get lectured from a naturopathic doctor like me, like eating right, exercise, getting sleep, healthy relationships, you know, blah, blah. Number three is protecting your body from that exposure. Repairing any damage is number four. And number five is then kill the mold. So in each of those tools, there are various things that you can pick and choose that match what you're willing to do. And not everybody needs to use every single tool, but you do need to use something from each of those 5 categories in order to break the mold.
So if you are someone, though, who's a librarian, that's your job,
mm-hmm.
What do you do? Because, I mean, you can't, you maybe can't stop being a librarian if that's how you're, you know,
making
your livelihood. If there are elements of your life where you really have to encounter mold, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so one of those situations is remediators. They do heroic work. They go into these water-damaged buildings. They know there's mold there. They wear all of the protective gear, but the toxins can get through their mask. So they have to be doing things to protect their bodies. So that entire section, protect, has like bioflavonoids. Those are the colorful parts of food that help to protect the effects of those toxins coming into the body. Not everybody is going to be genetically as sensitive as another person. Many of the remediators that worked on my home and have worked on homes of my patients, they kind of look at people like me that are what I call a mold canary in the coal mine because I react to everything mold. They would look at me and think, oh, I'm so glad I'm not that lady. You know, and they're much more hardy and they can handle being exposed to that. But I still lectured them, poor guys, about taking milk thistle because that has a specific benefit for mold exposure. And there has to be a certain amount in your system. So there are things that you can do that even if you know you're going to be exposed. Now, number one for them, they do protective equipment. That's the most important thing that they're doing. But also from a body standpoint, getting your body more resilient to that exposure. If you are a librarian, for example, and you're in a moldy library, remediation also has to happen. That's the complex part about mold, is that I can do everything to help the body, but then we need other building doctors to come and treat the building to really treat the cause.
All right. Well, Jill, thank you so much for coming in and talking about your book with us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Jill Krista is a naturopathic doctor who's based in Janesville. She's the author of a book titled Break the Mold, 5 Tools to Conquer Mold and Take Back Your Health. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Dr. Krista has a survey available on her website for those who are concerned that mold may be impacting their health. You can find a link to the survey at wuwm.com. We'll take one last break and then talk with several of the writers featured in the short story collection, Milwaukee Noir. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Noir exposes the underbelly of a place. In film or fiction, characters live in the shadows, denizens of a night where every good intention is punished. Noir found its natural home in New York City and L.A. in the 1940s and 50s, but now Milwaukee can lay claim to its own piece of the genre. Milwaukee Noir is a collection of 14 short stories edited by our next guest, Tim Hennessy. Two of the writers in the collection, Jennifer Morales and Valerie Lakin, joined Tim in the studio as well as he explains how the project began.
About 3 years ago, a friend of mine, Scott Phillips, was editing the St. Louis Noir anthology, and he had been in town and we met for coffee, and we were talking about projects that he was working on, and he had asked what I was working on, and at that time, really nothing was working. And he had said, oh, they're looking to do a Milwaukee one. I could mention you. And I thought, oh, that's amazing, but why would they possibly consider me? I do book reviews, and I do interviews, and I also am a bookseller, and my short fiction wasn't really kind of finding a home, so it seemed like a little bit of an unlikely matching to me. But he did reach out, and they were very interested, but their slate was full at the time. So I did mostly researching for a year, finding different authors I thought would lend themselves well to the project. And I wanted to incorporate a lot of different voices. So I was looking at journalists. I was looking at poets. I was looking at really anyone who could lend a really authentic sense of Milwaukee and what it's like to live here.
And it had to be new work, right?
Yes. All of it had to be first-time published work. And that was part of the challenge.
Okay. And how did you meet these two?
I was big fans of their work. I found both their books while working at Half Price Books. And it was just a matter of, you know, sometimes you're either getting a book in or you're shelving it and you think, oh, wow. And well, then seeing a Milwaukee connection, they definitely were people I looked deeper into their work and really fell in love with it. So they were, you know, right away, people I wanted to have involved.
Now, Jennifer, once you heard about it, did you want to do this? Or was there any resistance?
I have a policy to, if I'm physically capable of saying yes, I will say yes. That is my, you know, my message to the universe. If I get a writing invitation, I will try to say yes. I am not a noir writer by nature. I'm a happy ending, can't we all get along kind of person. So the idea of writing a story, and I'm thinking noir is like, you know, Raymond Chandler and the, you know, the gritty private investigator, mysterious dame walks into his office and he's, you know, polishing off a bottle of whiskey, you know.
I just think Humphrey Bogart, you know, when I hear noir, that's what I think.
Yeah. And you know, so I wanted to be open to that, but I had to set some rules for myself about how I would approach this new genre. But I definitely wanted to say yes, so I did. And my two rules were I was going to write queer noir. I was going to bring in some kind of gay or trans theme into it. And the other one was no guns. And I often write about children. And so somebody suggested, well, you could have a water gun fight. You know, that would be fun, a little squirt gun thing. So I did work that in. But then the story really demanded a gun. So there is a gun.
But so you broke one of your rules.
I broke one of my rules. But that's part of learning to write a new genre.
And Valerie, had you any experience with noir writing before this?
Not exactly, although my first novel did have a crime element. So, I mean, it wasn't something that was completely alien to me, but I guess I would have thought of myself as more of a sort of literary fiction writer. And I didn't have that much experience even reading noir. So the first thing I did when Tim contacted me was I just went out and bought some of those noirs from other cities, like Boston Noir, New York Noir, that sort of thing. And I thought, well, I could try that, and I thought it would be fun. The good news was that also Tim contacted us in the summer, I think, and I teach during the academic year, and so I'm always more inclined to say yes to things in the summer. I'm like, oh, sure, I have all summer. This will only take a weekend or so. I can write that story in 2 days.
Was that true?
No, I worked on it for like 6 months. I finished it like a day before the deadline in December or January, I can't remember. But there was one little kernel of an idea that I had been kicking around for a short story before Tim contacted me. And so when he contacted me, I thought, well, I could use that kernel for this story. And the kernel was that there's a manhole in the middle of my garage. And I've always wondered what it leads to and why it's there and what's down there. It's always kind of scared me a little bit. Every time I get out of my car, I step on it and it makes that rattly sound. And so my story ended up kind of following what happens down that manhole.
Tim, did you think of noir and Milwaukee together easily?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Why? What is it about Milwaukee and its environs that lends itself to the noir genre so well?
We have such a rich history, and it's always amazed me and fascinated me. And we have the socioeconomical conditions where there's so much conflict. Everywhere there is conflict in the city. I used to be a cable guy, so all day long I was traveling throughout neighborhoods throughout the city and the suburbs. So I constantly got to be in a lot of places and a lot of homes no one ever had access to. And you'd be inserted into conflicts and situations that a lot of times you're walking into the middle of a family during a crisis and they just happen to be getting cable. And so getting to see a lot of different neighborhoods really opened my eyes to the possibilities of just location. And certainly in my own work, I was always trying to figure out how to insert different aspects of different areas I'd see or different backgrounds and different economic classes. And there was never a lack of opportunity. And we have such a distinct culture here that I think goes ignored too often. And we don't often find anything in the city really or even the state represented in fiction that much. So that was something I was really excited to do. And certainly, I mean, we've got a lot of history of problems that keep rising up again and again. So that's always something thematic that crime fiction really draws on, is just how you kind of can't escape the past so much. Something bad happened in the past, and it sometimes can have reverberations to the future.
Well, often do. Yeah. You know, the idea that it just plays out into generations. I probably should have started with this question. What does noir mean to the two of you, the two writers? I mean, Tim's kind of described it for himself, but the two writers who are representing all of the rest of the writers in the book, Jennifer, what is noir?
I think it's darkness. I think it's about finding the underside of daily life. You know, I did go back. I did my research. I do my homework. I'm a good student. So, you know, I did go and read some Raymond Chandler. I read Patricia Highsmith. You know, I'm trying to go to the roots of the genre. And it feels to me that any story can be noir if you're looking at the underside of it, the shadow side, the dark side. And I'm really, really interested in complicated characters who are not They're not bad people, but they make bad choices or they have bad habits. And noir is great for that. So that's what I was looking for, is how do I show a protagonist who's a good person, who means to do right, but just messes everything up.
I was going to say, the thing I love about noir is that no one is perfect. You know, right. There's no perfection here. It's like everyone has something.
Yeah, the baseline assumption is that things are going to go wrong, that people commit crimes, that people are violent, right? In normal, I think in non-noir fiction, the assumption is these are more or less regular people and some bad things will happen to them. I think the assumption in noir is many of these people are bad. If you turn over a leaf, there will be something bad underneath it. Like the assumptions get reversed, right? The bad stuff, the crime, the violence, the darkness is assumed as a baseline. So there may be pockets of goodness buried in there, but I think that it's like the underworld.
Right. It's almost dystopian. Mm-hmm. In its outlook on life, there are these sparks of little brightness, but they get extinguished pretty quickly, you know?
And there's like a bigger tolerance for things like melodrama and like sleaziness, sexiness, cynical attitudes that I think kind of make it really fun to engage with both as a reader and as a writer.
Was it fun for the two of you to jump into this as writers?
Yeah, it was great fun because I now am talking with Tim about possibly doing a workshop at some point called Writing Dark, because it did change how I'm looking at my non-noir fiction. Anytime I learn something new about how to write is very exciting for me.
I was going to say, in a good way? Did it change it in a good way?
Yeah, it really opened me up to like, no, your characters are tough. They can handle a little more sleazy, sexy, whatever Valerie does, and the beautiful alliteration, you know, violence. I can hurt them more.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the resilience ends up showing more dimension, and the conflict just kind of really escalates things, too, because in a lot of noir fiction or just in crime fiction in general, you know, bad things happen, and then they get worse, and you can... There's a lot of tone range that you can take that. You can, you know, there's certainly a lot of comic noirs that use and comic crime stuff that really kind of just exaggerate those features. And then certainly the more dramatic ones that really just build on that and just bring the characters into a much worse spot than they started off.
I was going to say, and both of you kind of are in that ladder. These stories are both in that ladder category. And I'm hoping maybe each of you would read just a little bit. I don't want to give away each story. I want people to come and read them. But Jennifer, you said you wanted to include queer and LGBT themes in yours. How did you do that?
Well, I feel like this story has two protagonists. I don't know if that's allowed in fiction. Maybe not. But there is the main character, Marta. She's our point of view character, is a gay Mexican-American woman from the South Side. Her cousin, who is known as Carlisa, joins the military, goes off to Afghanistan with the army, and comes back and announces to the family that she would like to be known as Carlos now, and addressed as he. And so that was the way that I brought in tension that I feel in the Latino community around gay and trans identities.
And it brings a certain extra darkness to the story that you're telling because of these layers,
It does. Yeah. I like that layering of the precariousness of their lives, that it's not just that they're threatened by the outside world, but even within their family, there's a struggle to accept this evolving person.
Is there a paragraph that you would share with us?
I can read a little bit from Marta talking to her mom on the phone and trying to get her mom to use the right pronoun for Carlos. Carlos has disappeared, so Marta is looking for him. I called my mom from the street outside. Have you seen Carlos? She made the humming noise she always did before she lied or held something back. Today? No, mi amor, not since yesterday. Yesterday? When did you see him yesterday? More humming. Well, she went to talk to her mom and... You should say he, mommy. Well, they had a little talk and then I don't know where she went. That's it? You have no idea where he is now? An icy feeling rushed down my spine. My mom could be evasive for a lot of reasons, politeness, shyness with strangers, fear. She did it all the time, but this felt different. You could ask your tia. I'll do that. So throughout the story, Marta's trying to be the ambassador and say, we need to accept Carlos for who he is and how he wants to be addressed. And as the story progresses, the family unfortunately continues to fail to get the message. And Marta misses the message in her own ways, too.
Yes. Yeah, she's, again, we talk about that not, there's no perfection. She's not a perfect character either.
Right. Right?
Even though she's well-meaning.
Yeah.
So, Valerie, you have a very different setup. It takes place on the East Side, and that manhole cover figures into it.
Yeah, the story is narrated by a high school girl who's been living in the streets with a few friends of hers. So she's sort of homeless, and she's been given an assignment by one of her teachers to write a letter of appeal or complaint to a politician. And so the story itself is a letter to the mayor of Milwaukee. We shouldn't have been there in the first place. That's the problem with telling you anything real. We should have been tucked into soft little beds, dreaming of algebra or homecoming or whatever. We shouldn't have been creeping through the sewers under your city. I know that much. We shouldn't have been hunched up like rodents, sweeping our flashlights along the damp, scratchy walls, trying not to hit our heads while we searched for those metal rungs that lead up to manholes. Don't worry, I'm not talking about your real sewer system, Mr. Mayor, that deep channel of filth that flows down to Jones Island and fills up Lake Michigan. I'm talking about the old spiderweb of pipes that runs closer to the surface, under the East Side. Maybe you don't even know it exists, but we do. Me, Diego, and JJ, we drop down into it at night because some of those manholes don't open onto streets or alleys like you would expect. They open up into the garages of people like you. And people like you store all kinds of pawnable stuff in your garages, so much that you forget you ever even had it. I bet 9 out of 10 people we hit don't even know they've been robbed. So how bad am I really supposed to feel about it?
Terrific. Well, I want to thank all three of you for coming in this morning. This is great. And just thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tim Hennessy edited the short story collection Milwaukee Noir. Jennifer Morales and Valerie Lakin are two of the contributors to the collection. We get used to things. It could be a squeaky hinge on a door that we just don't hear anymore, or the way we automatically dodge the edge of a counter that sticks out just a little too far. As Lake Effect essayist Mel Miskimmin works on her house, she wonders if she's become too laid back.
I was in the upstairs front bedroom stripping the 1880s walls of 1980s wallpaper. It was a Saturday morning. The neighborhood was in the process of waking itself up, figuring out the plan for the rest of the day. And then, pop, 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 gunshots. Close enough for me to hear the ping, ping, ping of spent cartridges hitting the pavement. So, what did I do? Grab my phone? Call 911? No. I moved the ladder, put on latex gloves, and continued my assault on Laura Ashley's thistle pattern. I hadn't heard any follow-up volleys, no screaming, no squealing tires, nothing that would have required my immediate attention. If it hadn't been for the 15-minute waiting period for the wallpaper dissolving solution to take effect, I wouldn't have gone outside to see if maybe there might be anything. I grabbed a plastic bag in case the perp was still out there, thinking they would think I wasn't looking for anything incriminating, just litter, when the police pulled up and started taping off the street. The officers moved at a pace that didn't belie any urgency. You want to know what the shocking part was? Not the fact there was a shooting or that the victim had called 911 and driven themselves to the hospital, but that the police department allowed man buns. Officer Man Bun took notes on what I had seen and heard. I told him the exact number of shots, gave a description of a car, the occupants. Unfortunately, it had had no plates. He complimented me on my observational skills. I told him I had been trained from an early age to notice distinguishing marks, remember license plate numbers, because my father had been a police officer. Oh, he said, where? Milwaukee, I said, 40 years. Wow, he said. Indeed, I said. I had been working on a project and had my father's old police notebooks from the 50s and 60s. I ran inside, grabbed a few, gave them to Officer Manbun. He chuckled as he read the accounts of knife fights, foul language, drunks, kids throwing rocks. He sighed, "Seems almost quaint." I brought up the 1960s and 70s when I was a teenager and my father was the man, definitely not quaint. Must have been interesting, he said. I'd have gone with difficult, I said. Apparently the shooting had been an old boyfriend versus new boyfriend kind of drama. Words had been exchanged before the shots had been fired. Yeah, they unfortunately used the same drug dealer and that's how they both ran into each other. Awkward, I said. I hate when that happens. They had pretty much wrapped up their investigation, the crime scene no longer taped off. I went back to my task, peeling wallpaper off the walls in large pieces, like sunburned skin from my husband's back, as if nothing had happened. Because I guess that's where we are now.
Lake Effect essayist Mel Maskimmon is the author of Cop's Kid and Sit, Stay, Heal. She lives in Milwaukee. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.